That's the Cable Evening News for Wednesday, November 8th, 2006, marking the 1,878th day since Bush made the declaration that he would catch Osama bin Laden, dead or alive. Keep looking, mister. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us with those at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our assistant producer and audio editor is Lisa Loving. Our wire editor is Jim Thompson. Special thanks to our reporters, whoever they are, and engineer Brianna Loringer. This KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afif Ahmed Sheffi. Coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Joanne Bowman hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. She'll discuss what's next for Oregon following yesterday's election. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, Martha Odom interviews Adele Kubin of Military Families Speak Out about the long-term effects of deployment to Iraq on soldiers and their families. At 10, it's Chicanismo. Host Carlos Chavez presents Part 2 of the Mexican-American War, featuring a historian from the University of Southern California. At 10:30 on Art Focus, host Julie Bernard welcomes Portland artist Brad Atkins. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit volunteer-powered and listener-sponsored community radio station. Volunteer with our humble broadcasts by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203. Thanks for joining us.
Nothing but money.
Our 9 to 5 is stars in the PM. So I step out in the AM. The street is black and shiny from the nightly rain. The glory of the light brings evaporation. Mornings fresh, oxygen cleanest. I take a deep hit, help my mind stay the greenest. I'm already baked, so I'm not drinking coffee. Don't want a cigarette, cause it's a form of slavery. Walk into the store, cause I need a few items. The sun heats my blood like a hit of vitamins. I need to buy some food, some poop for my dreads. I can't remember why, but I need a spool of thread. Well, a man with dirty dreads, he steps around the corner. He asks me for a dime, a nickel or a quarter. I don't have any change, so I'm stepping along. But as I'm walking past, he sings to me a song. There's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza, there's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza, dear Liza, there's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza, Liza, there's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza, dear Liza. The day's picking up, cause I'm humming the song. The buses and the people are
ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around.
Hole in the Bucket. Good evening. This is Michael Anderson. You are listening to Hole in the Bucket on 90.7 FM on your dial. I'm here this evening with my co-host, Jay Thiemeyer. And we are very happy tonight. We have a big show. We're going to have a guest on this evening. We're going to have get him on the line here in a second. Paul Bowden from the organization RAP from San Francisco. We also have Israel Baer in the studio tonight from Street Roots. Hello, Israel.
Hello. How's it going?
Very good. Very good. So tonight's show, we're going to be talking about two very specific things, and then to get into a conversation about a larger trend around what I think all of us here around the table hope is a growing and emerging movement to deal with poverty, the lack of housing that's affordable, and the offshoot, which is people having to live on the streets. One thing to sort of get us started is I think there's been a lot of discussion in the news over the last couple of years about plans to end homelessness. At the same time, I think what all of us have seen is that we may be going in the exact opposite direction. Next week, the Oregon Education Department is going to release numbers. I don't have the privilege of giving the exact numbers out yet. They're still embargoed. But last year, we had 11,000 homeless students in the Oregon schools statewide. This year, I understand it's over 13,000. So at the same time that we've been working towards ending homelessness, we've seen a distinct rise among families and extreme challenges for many people who, if they're not living on the streets now, maybe just hanging on in an apartment, couch surfing with friends, et cetera. So well, I'm going to see if we have Paul on the line. I'm thinking that we may. Paul, can you hear me? Oh, we're still a little bit away here. Oh, I'm getting the nod now. Jay, I think we have Paul here. Paul, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you very much. This is Michael.
Hey, Michael.
Welcome, Paul. This is Jay Thiemeyer. It's nice to hear you.
Hi, nice to be talking to you again, Jay.
Thanks.
So, Paul, we just while we were waiting to get you on the air, we were just talking about some figures that are going to be released officially next week, talking that Oregon last year reported having 11,000 homeless children enrolled in the schools. This coming year, they're going to come out. The report's going to say it's over 13,000. And we thought that that in some ways was a good segue opening into talking a little bit about the report Without Housing that you guys are about to release and how that relates to these current efforts we see around the country to end homelessness.
I got to say this report has been a real experience for us. We started RAP a little bit over a year ago just because so many of the really committed social justice-based poverty organizations around the country were looking at how we're addressing homelessness and how we've been addressing it for going on since 1987 with the federal government's involvement since 1983 as local communities. And 30 years later, we're still seeing the same results, which is an ever-increasing number of people who are ending up out in the street. So you have to, at some point, you have to stop and look at it and say, all right, wait, so we've tried rehabilitating homeless people for 30 years, and the problem continues to get worse in our society. So let's take a look at societal structures and see if there's something that isn't functioning properly within our society. And this report was the end result of groups getting together and saying, let's look at the systems.
Paul, for people who aren't familiar with RAP, that stands for Western Regional Advocacy Project, and it includes locally Sisters of the Road Cafe. And the subtitle of your report, which just came out, the title is Without Housing, and the subtitle is Decades of Federal Housing Cutbacks massive homelessness, and policy failures. And basically what you do is trace the cuts deriving from the Reagan era, when 80% of HUD's funding was cut, and there's never been any rebuilding of that, no return to the kind of financing you had before Reagan. It's a really good historical perspective on exactly what we're facing, a crisis that's getting worse.
Well, thank you for that. And you know, the sort of simplicity within that of, well, let's look at the issue of homelessness, and then let's look at HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department, and the United States Department of Agriculture, which actually administers the rural housing programs. And let's see if there was anything happening within those housing programs that might be connected to the fact that in the early 1980s, all of these people in communities across the country started ending up ass out in the street.
Right.
And bang, it hits you like a rock. You see this massive decline. And it actually started 79, the last year of Carter's administration, when he was getting beat up on by Reagan running for president and what was going on in Iran, the Iranian hostage stuff, and a recession that was hitting our economy. He started making some cuts, which always makes me then look at Habitat for Humanity a little differently. But Reagan came in and just massively wiped out the programs.
Right.
And that's where I say, you know, it's so ironic to hear the federal government, and scary for poor people across the country to hear that the Republicans are the lead party in addressing homelessness, because both the National Alliance to End Homelessness and the Interagency Council on Homelessness are Republican-created entities, that these are the leaders in how do we address homelessness. And what is their major priority of a program? Is to continue to cut the public housing, continue to cut Section 8 and CDBG, Community Development Block Grants, and emphasize that we're gonna use homelessness money to master lease hotels that are already existing and put single adults in there so that we can claim we've got a homeless program.
Well, I know Alfonso Jackson, the head of HUD, has said that poverty is just a state of mind, so it's not very encouraging to have a person like that at the helm.
Well, and, you know, one of the greatest ironies, and I hope that people will, you know, go to the website. Anybody that wants to can download this report after we release it on Tuesday for free off of the website. But all during the same period of time, the same 30 years or 28 years that this trend has continued, unabated, mm-hmm. continued. So you're talking about $52 billion a year over 27 years. That's a lot of housing money.
Now, that website, is that raphome.org?
Yes, it is. I'm sorry.
So that's www.raphome.org.
One word, yeah.
Right.
Raphome, one word.
Raphome, and we'll repeat that again with a W. Paul, I want to.
But can I just finish that thought for a second?
Absolutely.
Simultaneously, the mortgage interest deduction programs that overwhelmingly benefit wealthier households, mortgage companies, and real estate industry has gone from $40 billion a year as a program of the federal government to $122 billion a year.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that just blew me away about the report. This is all information as a person myself who spent a lot of years as a housing professional and as an advocate. I had a general understanding of these trends, but that really blew me away, because one of the assertions in your report, right, is essentially it's not that we're spending any less money on housing. It's that we've shifted our priorities so that we're helping people who in most cases are extremely comfortably housed and in many cases own multiple houses.
And we're doing it because the National Realtors Association and the mortgage companies that back them have been adamant and aggressive in saying, you can't touch this program, because if you do, the cost of housing will go down. Well, so the whole emphasis of the overwhelming majority of the money that we're spending on subsidizing housing in the United States is driving an economic engine to keep prices up. Why? Because that's where the real estate market makes their money.
So in other words, as far as for regular people, it's that our housing plan is like a diet where you're eating brownies to lose weight.
And it's also that what's good for corporations is good for America, and therefore the agenda of the corporate welfare is more important than the welfare of the people and the community. And that's the trickle down.
Another point that you make is the diversion of money to defense and to the Iraq war, the military venturing in the Middle East, and how that drains money from domestic programs. I liked your comparison, for example, of the expense of different, for example, submarines and so on. And
well, and if you notice, it's only one submarine.
Right, exactly.
You know, we purposefully, you know, with the fact that we were trying to make some clarifying comparisons, to look at the whole $500 billion military-industrial complex budget. And that's just the money that we know about. There's a whole section that they call the black budget, which nobody sees. But the $500 billion is what we were able to document. We know that that's currently what's being allocated. One destroyer is $3.3 billion. Mm. All public housing capital expenses, which is the money that's used for the actual acquisition or for the actual development of housing, $2.5 billion. So, right. You know, we have in our fleet right now, in the Navy, there's over 400 ships and 2,300 airplanes.
I'm sorry,
180 warships and 2,300 aircraft.
Right, it's extraordinary. You have the comparison, for example, you have a great graph here with some comparisons. One, Arleigh Burke, Aegis destroyer, $1.17 billion. All new Section 8 and public housing units from 96 to the present, zero.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that strikes me that, Paul, I'd be interested to get your comments for our readers, because I'm really – for our listeners, I'm really hoping our listeners are going to download this report, because I think it's something – you really need to sit down with it and absorb it. I mean, this is a serious piece of research. And that's what I want to get to for a second here, because in some ways this report is very radical in its conclusions, radical in that it's not what the current mainstream is talking about at all. On the other hand – Where did you get all this data? Is this pulled from, you know, some random blogger?
No, actually, the majority of the data itself came from the federal government. It came from the president's office and a commission that he formed on taxation through the General Accounting Office. We got access to that. It came from HUD. It came from Global Securities. It came from, you know, months and months and months and months of following the trail and, you know, trying to not look at the monkey and trying to track the stuff down. But there's 122 citations on the data that is compiled. And I will say a big chunk of it came also from the 2004, it's called the Green Book, which is the actual budget and an explanation of the budget that's produced at the federal level. But I also have to credit an awesome woman who had unfortunately passed away just a little while ago named Cushing Dolbrer, mm-hmm. who had put together some of these charts, not exactly what we have. We played with it with her permission, and we took the National Low-Income Housing Coalition's out-of-reach report and applied it to and pulled out the pieces of it that we felt directly related to homelessness. And so the trail that we followed, a lot of that was initiated by Cushing's work.
I want to talk about one other aspect of the report that I think is really outstanding and unique. That in addition, so you've just shared with our listeners about the factual credibility of this report. And I think it's to use a word that I love to use nowadays, unimpeachable. But the other thing that you did is you decided instead of letting this data stand alone as all these huge, unapproachable numbers, that you would work with artists to bring these numbers to light to make things more understandable. Could you talk about that process and why you decided to go in that direction?
Well, first of all, when you look at any movement that's been of any substance throughout the history of people, you've always seen an artistic and a spiritual aspect to it. But when you look at homelessness over the last 25 years, 30 years, most of the images about us, and I came up off the street, and I would look at these data, these reports that would be put out about us, and I couldn't relate to it. First of all, I couldn't understand most of it. And secondly, it would get into this abstract stuff that just couldn't, it was so difficult to connect it to what I was seeing and living and experiencing every day. And so for us to take the kind of passion that Street Roots and Sisters of the Road, Los Angeles Community Action Network, the San Francisco Homeless Coalition, the kind of passion that they bring to the work that they do, and just have it sit in a dry, sort of passionless format of data and tables and charts, it just seemed like it seemed criminal to do that. And we were very lucky to have as a friend Art Hazelwood, who created the cover image on the report and one of the pieces of artwork in it as well, who had been for years donating artwork to an art auction that the Homeless Coalition did every year. And other lefty, progressive, social justice, whatever you want to call it, artists would contribute artwork to us, and we would use that as a fundraising event. And Art Hazelwood and I just both felt like there needed to be a stronger connection there, that artists should be part of the organizing work that's going on. This campaign where there's artwork actually taking the data from this report and bringing life to that data through art is also something we're doing with civil rights, and we're going to be doing with other issues as an ongoing piece of our organizing work, which is, you know, the organizers, the homeless people that are doing the outreach and the local level, they bring the message. And then the artist part of that overall campaign and then of that overall work is to help bring life to that message. Because, and you know, people aren't going to hang a data chart up on their wall. But that incorporates that data, that's done as a really slick, I mean, these are great pieces of art. They also happen to be informative.
Paul, I have to say, I have the report here in front of me, and just flipping through it, the graphics are just really do bring it alive. It's just literally a joy to read through this, even though the numbers are pretty dismal. But it just comes alive here. It isn't dry as dust by any means.
Yeah, well, no, and I'm not trying to diss it. I mean, we did, like, about a year ago when we really – I mean, I've been going around with these charts, other versions of them, for 5 years, trying to get people to look at, you know, I'm not just opposing these stupid 10-year plans that the federal government's having everybody write. Right. I'm opposing those stupid 10-year plans because I'm looking at what created the problem and what are we doing to address it. And there's no connection between life skills training for homeless people and the answer to how come we have so much homelessness in our country today. And so, you know, we originally had talked about having this report sort of be unbiased or, you know, just the facts, ma'am, type of a report. I found that we're constitutionally unable to do that. you can't look at this information and you can't look at what's going on with poverty and racism and the class structure and the fact that our government has been bought. It's been bought. We have to get it unbought. So it's not even a matter of we have to stop corporate America. They've already bought our government.
Exactly.
And our lives and what we have to say and what we feel are the priorities isn't at all what's being debated on Capitol Hill.
Paul, I'd like to ask you, I first met you in June at the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council conference here in Portland. And could you, I know that tomorrow, for example, there's an audio conference online that titled Housing is Healthcare. And that's at noon tomorrow. It can be reached online. If you check out the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council website, which is nhchc.org, could you talk about your involvement with that? Because healthcare is obviously a critical piece along with housing. They're not disconnected.
When we were first bringing RAP together, the National Coalition Executive Director is a man by the name of John Lozier. Very committed, very, very decent man. And years ago, the Chicago Coalition, Picture the Homeless in New York, the San Francisco Coalition, and a couple of other groups that were part of the National Coalition for the Homeless had sort of set up and formed, put together on paper, how as a national organization we could start developing a stronger message. And to me, if we're going to change what's going on in D.C., we're going to have to do it from the local level. There isn't going to be the great white savior that comes and represents all of us and influences Washington, D.C.
So you don't think that the election results are going to be some magical cure?
I think the election results are great in terms of sending a message. I think that power doesn't just seed itself. Mm-hmm. Government and institutions don't just give you respect. It's almost an oxymoron to say, you should give me respect. We have to earn the respect by having our information together, by having a unified message, or at least a respect and a compassion for each other as organizations throughout the country. And then we have to demand respect and demand that our priorities be the priorities of what is technically supposed to be our government. And most poor people don't look at the United States government and think, that's mine. I control that. That body works for me. And it keeps us isolated. It keeps us fearful. It keeps us paranoid of each other. And so long as we stay out in the streets and only shoot each other, they're going to let us continue to do that.
I agree. The power we have is our numbers, and we need to organize. And that's exactly what RAP is doing.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit specifically about RAP? Obviously, this report is a major piece that RAP has worked on and developed. But talk a little bit more about where's RAP going? What's RAP's immediate plans with this report? And then where do you see RAP fitting in the development and cultivation of a movement for change?
Well, one of the first thing we did, our first big project a year and a little bit ago, was in working with the Healthcare for the Homeless group. We helped them and showed them and are doing ongoing trainings with them about how to have greater involvement and greater direction from what they call their consumers, the clients of Healthcare for the Homeless health centers, of which there's like 148 across the country, through doing outreach and through creating systems of legitimate, accountable representation. And representation means I'm not telling you what I think. I'm telling you what the majority of the people I ask the questions of, what they think. And that's legitimate representation, and you can build that. And it becomes an ongoing dialogue. It doesn't become a one-way street. And it also means that everybody brings something to the table. And so in applying that to RAP as an organization, the people in L.A. that coming off of Skid Row have really strong sets of skills that they bring to the table. Sisters of the Road, having done the kind of work that they do and the nonviolent approach that they take to this work, bring a really strong set of skills to the table. They're totally different sets of skills. And so in some areas, Sisters of the Road is the trainer, and we're learning from them. And everybody around the table is sometimes a trainer, sometimes being taught.
Right. Collaboration seems to be the key.
What's that?
Collaboration seems to be the key, using what each has to contribute to make the whole that much stronger.
And it also is, it's so much more real, you know? Like, nobody's perfect, and yet everybody has something to offer. And that's the way you know, having been coming up off the street and working in organizations, you know, I finally hooked up with this group, Hospitality House, in the Tenderloin here in San Francisco, because they didn't look at me and say, oh, well, you need to be rehabilitated to fit back into society. They looked at me and said, what do you want to do? How do you want to be a part of what we're doing?
They didn't try.
And that opportunity to be bigger, to be a part of something that was bigger than just me, that's what we're trying to bring to the organizations that come into RAP.
Right. Not case management, but empowerment.
So
well, it's not. It's more about if L.A. can by themselves, or real change by themselves, or whoever, isn't going to change what's going on in Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, we can't point to any organization that's going to rep them effectively right now and say that organization's going to change what's going on in D.C. So what we need to do is create our own voice and our own message, and create it in a way that it is absolutely not about winning or losing as much as it is about being accountable to the people that you're talking about. When anybody comes to me and says, we think this, I'm always going to look behind them and say, who's we? I see you sitting there, but if I can't see that you're actually legitimately representing whoever we is, then I'm not going to listen to a damn thing you say.
Paul, we're going to take a short musical break here, and then we're going to come back with Israel Bear, and we're going to start talking about street newspapers and some of the trends and changes we see in them. So hold tight. You're listening to KBOO 90.7. This is Odetta.
Ain't gonna let ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. And I'm walking down that freedom, talking down that freedom, walking down that freedom road.
Welcome back. This is KBOO 90.7, Hole in the Bucket, the homeless show. There are things to be grateful for in this world, and Odetta is certainly one of them. I want to repeat the website for the Western Regional Advocacy Project, which we have just been talking about for the first half with Paul Bowden in San Francisco. That is very simply www.wraphome.org. Rap home, one word. I'd now like to introduce Israel Baer, who is the director of Street Roots, Portland's homeless paper. Welcome, Israel.
Thank you. It's very exciting to be here on Hole in the Bucket, and I really appreciate being here.
Right. We're looking forward to hearing what you have to say about, to update us on what Street Roots is doing. I know there are a lot of things that are going on that you're working on. Could you?
It's a very exciting time right now in the street newspaper movement. We had our first international conference in Montreal this last year, and for the first time, the entire globe is starting to work together with street newspapers, and we have right now over 106 street newspapers in 17 languages all working together for the first time. So it's very, very exciting.
That's amazing. Well, what is your role with the international board?
I currently sit on the North American Street Newspaper Association. Is a regional network of the international street newspaper organization. So NASNA represents 28 newspapers across North America, and we are, again, as I said, a regional network that's working with other continents around the world to actually help build their regional networks so that we can better organize and do work together.
And then Joanne Zuhl, the managing editor of Street Roots, is involved with the international board, is that correct?
That's correct. Joanne sits on the International Street Newspaper Board, and they are currently working on issues ranging from how we can effectively work on social justice actions and campaigns together, how voting rights work within the larger group, how all the newspapers can be represented and feel represented. So we're both doing a lot of work locally and nationally and internationally. And she's off to Scotland next week to meet face-to-face with the board from people from all over the world to work on this stuff.
Right. One of the things that gets me so excited is, first of all, I have to admit, and perhaps this is ignorance on my own part, I didn't know there was an international street paper movement until we had a conversation that sort of led to you coming on the show. Talk about where you see this going. What's the promise here? What's the path that lies ahead?
There's a lot of benefits for us all being able to communicate and use technology in the way that it's going. And one of those benefits is we created what's called the Street News Service. And it's you can go visit it at streetnewsservice.org. And what that is basically it's a news wire and a content sharing mechanism for the papers all around the world. So we can collaborate on news stories, on columns, on opinions. For instance, Street Roots last year did a feature on sex workers in Portland, and we matched that with a big issue in Namibia. And we both ran a side-by-side expose on sex workers. So we're able to utilize different voices from different areas of the world and not only report on those very same issues affecting people locally, but also internationally, and better inform people.
It was fascinating listening to you talk about St. Petersburg, Russia. Could you describe that?
Yeah, St. Petersburg, Russia. The newspaper there has been at the forefront at making people on the streets in Russia who are dying at a very large rate. They're freezing to death, and the newspaper in St. Petersburg was very key in making that an international issue, and they've been spearheading that. So, again, the limits, the sky's the limit with what we can do and starting to coordinate this stuff. So with St. Petersburg using what they were seeing on the ground, we were able to disseminate that throughout the Street Newspaper Network and better inform people. And one thing led to another, and it became an international issue.
Could you talk about some of the papers in the third world? I mean, in Africa and South America.
It's I believe, 20 papers in Africa, and I believe 16 in South America. And it's fascinating to work with newspapers from all different backgrounds, and poverty looks so much different in different regions of the world, and it's important for us to all be able to come together and work on the same side of the fence. And you know, what we're seeing in, for example, one of the big issues that we were facing as a street newspaper we were voting on is, do we allow people that are 13 or 14 years old to be able to sell the newspaper? Because in some of the developing world, you have newspapers in Brazil that have youth programs that, you know, people are 13 or 14 years old selling the newspaper. And it became an ideology difference across borders. And so we had to be able to educate one another and come together as a group and say, yes, you know, this may be X, Y, and Z looked at as negative in some places, but we have to respect where people are coming from. So, it varies from place to place.
Well, you respect cultural diversity, whether it's global or local.
That's right. That's right. One of the more fascinating and frightening things is, you know, in North America, when we as a network entered into the international community, obviously in the state of the world we are in today, we're not looked at very kindly. And so there was a lot of apprehension from other groups on other continents when we entered in as a North American newspaper association entered into the community. So, but one of the things that we found out about one another was that while business models in Europe, in the United States, looked similar, the vendor programs for newspapers in North America and South America actually looked had more in common than what we had thought. Because in Europe, with socialized medicine and the way things are, a lot of the vendors' basic needs, to some degree, are taken care of much more than they are here in North America. So when we saw that varying issues were running parallel, and we were able to capitalize on that and how we move forward and create campaigns out of that.
For folks who regularly read Street Roots, what does this involvement on a larger scale mean for our paper here? Can people expect to see a difference in the next issue? Is this something that we would see over time in terms of the impact of this wider exposure to information and sharing?
I think over the last year, we've tried to incorporate voices from other parts of the world into the newspaper. And if you're an avid reader of Street Roots, you'll have noticed that we've tried to bring more of a global voice into the newspaper. If you're not, it's a very exciting time, because one of the things that we're able to do is bring voices from other countries. And instead of having a newspaper that's an intellectual writing about Brazil and poverty in Brazil, we're able to have voices of people living in poverty in Brazil incorporated in the newspaper. And it makes it a much different dynamic in the way you look at media and the way information is distributed. And so it's really great to be able to bring what's happening on the ground into the local paper.
I'm interested. When I think of successful street newspapers in this country, I think of Streetwise in Chicago, Spare Change in Boston, Real Change, Street Roots. Being from the South, are there successful papers down there, say in Atlanta? Or
There was a newspaper that just started in Atlanta. There's a newspaper in Austin, and there's a newspaper in Miami, Florida. The South is a hard nut to crack in more than one way. But concerning people on the streets, it's more of a car culture. A lot of downtowns in the South don't see the walking traffic, so the newspapers haven't been as popular. Also, the heat is a big issue. You know, in some places, you know, when it's getting over 100 degrees, having someone stand in one place all day long selling a newspaper hasn't been quite as successful. And on the flip side of that, you know, the general public hasn't been as accepting as, you'll look at the more successful newspapers like Street Sheet in San Francisco and Real Change in Seattle and Boston. And you can almost look at the more liberal or whatever you want to call it, cities, and say you can match those up with more successful street newspapers where people buy into the idea of having a face-to-face relationship with vendors while getting a great source of news.
How about Philadelphia? I think of the Kensington Welfare Rights Organization. There seemed to be a lot of activity around.
No paper in Philly. Mm.
Paul, are you still with us? Oh, it looks like we lost Paul. We'll get him back here in a second. But let's shift the conversation here to talk about one of the things that we were talking about earlier with Paul is within all the individual effort and work to make some change around poverty, around housing issues, around social justice issues. There's a lot of us who have operated in silos without having the infrastructure and building towards something larger. RAP is one model.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about this, what you're talking about in terms of, I've heard you talk about infrastructure, building communications relations. Talk about how this relates to the larger thrust of social change.
Well, I think that there's, you know, in my own personal opinion, there's no doubt the left's been fractured for a very long time. And I think that we have taken a step back from pushing and looked at how we can build infrastructure and what it means to actually do that. There's currently a homeless think tank that has been created in Portland. And we're looking at messaging. We're looking at what other successful campaigns have been done. We're not just going out there and trying to do it all ourselves, but actually looking and studying and researching success stories, not only in the United States, but around the world. And by doing that, we're taking all of our energy, and we are putting into that. And the potential, you know, we've been exploring anything from boycotts, tourist boycotts of cities internationally or nationally that either one, there's police squads in some areas of the world that have been documented as killing homeless people, and we've explored the idea of putting together a boycott. We're exploring how, you know, working with different groups like RAP, how can we disseminate and work with other progressive organizations on these topics? And, you know, RAP is a phenomenal organization, and the idea that being able to bring social justice groups working on the homeless front together up and down the West Coast has been an energizer, and it's brought together all of our experiences and knowledge, and we all can use that in a way that can be not only rowdy and raise a lot of hell, but it can be successful at what we do. And so, you know, that's where we're at right now.
Well, I think that's really exciting, especially thinking about in terms of synthesis between elements like street papers that are using media to grassroots groups that are doing research, and then that coalesces around organizing. It's a shame. I guess we lost Paul. I'm getting a little buzz that we'll get Paul back on the air here, because I think that we were going to open this conversation up to some ideas around that. But one of the things is Street Roots is actively engaged in the promotion of this RAP report. Do you want to talk about that and what Street Roots is going to do to help get more people aware that this information's been pulled together?
Yeah, Street Roots is currently working with Sisters of the Road Cafe, which is an active member of RAP. And we, I had gotten the privilege to work with Paul and RAP at Real Change and with NASNA up in Seattle. So I had been working with the group. And we came together and we developed an idea here in Portland that why don't we take the street newspapers up and down the West Coast? And starting next week, vendors will be selling postcards with some of the really great artwork that we've been talking about. And it will point to the RAP report on the website, and it will come with a button so people can identify themselves with a button that says housing is a crisis. So a lot of vendors are going to be out selling those buttons, so look for them next week.
And how much would a button and a postcard be?
A button and a postcard will be $1, but we developed you get the button. The postcards are really nice color. You can either send one to your family And really, once you see the artwork that's on this on it, it's just fantastic. It's something you can put up on your fridge. You can put you can put it in the windshield of your car. You can put it in many different places. So when you go out and buy the button and the postcard, it's going to have a multiple. Multiple uses, and the most so, it's going to go. A dollar is going to go directly to somebody on the streets or living in poverty who's selling it. So,
well, and for our listeners out there, let me tell you, you can't see this art right now because we're on radio. But we're really talking about some tremendous pieces, and especially, I think, you know, as much as the consumer madness that happens around the holidays is a little bit, at least personally, sickening to me, these are a great gift idea.
Yeah.
I mean, these postcards here, you're talking about something. It's beautiful. It's compelling. It's informative. And, you know, as Israel was saying, I mean, this is going to go directly towards helping somebody find the basic sustenance. So I think... All right, we got Paul back in the line. Paul, can you hear me?
I didn't like what I was saying, and you hung up on me.
That's right. You know what? We got a call from D.C., and they say, well, enough of this radical claptrap.
Uh-huh.
Give us more of the same. So we've been talking about the 10-year plan since.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Rumsfeld is retired, so now he's listening into KBOO, and he was pissed off.
So actually, Paul, to bring you up to speed, Israel just gave us a great overview of some of the changes that we're seeing internationally, nationally, and here locally around street papers. And we'd begun to talk about how between the work that's going on with the street newspapers, similar to what you're talking about with RAP, that infrastructure is being laid to help improve our ability to enact and affect social change. Do you want to expand on that? I know you have background in street papers as well.
Yeah, I mean, and Israel's absolutely right. I mean, that there's, you know, when people, the way you learn is you make mistakes. And so, you know, as we've been growing, there's enough people that have stuck around and have really started taking seriously that we're building something. We're not just reacting anymore to the fact that we lost our housing, but we're actually building something to create change. And that's the energy that's so positive about what's out there right now at the community level. And people, if they just look beyond the mainstream media, beyond Fox News and that kind of garbage, and really look at what's out there and the skills and the talents that people are bringing to this work, you know, it's an incredible energy, because you do still spend a lot of your time. And I know Israel, and I'm sure you've heard it with Street Roots, you know, people would say, oh, Paul, but the street sheet's depressing. Well, we are more and more able to bring in some really positive stuff that's going on that isn't just, oh, look, Joe Blow got rehabilitated. Now he's fit in. Now he's working for Bank of America, but is the skills and the talents of people that happen to be poor and homeless, and creating places for them to get those skills out there and to let the people see what's going on. And it's really amazing stuff.
I think the interesting thing about Street Roots, for example, is, for one thing, it makes people who are curious about homelessness aware of the reality of homelessness, what the experience is, the fact that homelessness is not diminishing, even though it's not on the front page as much as it was 20 years ago. But in fact, homelessness is increasing. There's segments, single mothers, for example, whose proportion of the homeless population is increasing. The homeless population generally is increasing. And Street Roots helps make people aware of that. It also helps galvanize people who want to do something to address homelessness. And I think that the credibility that Street Roots, for example, and RAP is, for example, with this report, Without Housing, is developing, is that it gathers interest and people who want to give support. For example, with Street Roots, I know that Israel, you're developing an advisory panel, which is basically collaboration of people who bring different resources to bear on dealing with homelessness. And could you talk about, like, the networking and the collaboration that represents.
Yeah. Street Roots is at a place where we're building a lot of infrastructure as well. And we've put together an advisory panel full of people in the community that have expertise that we don't have. And, for far too long, we've been butting our heads up against a wall trying to do things that we didn't always have, one, the resources to do, or two, the knowledge to be able to do. And so what we're doing is we're just trying to incorporate as many voices, as much expertise, to look at short-term planning, mid-term, long-term, how can we be effective today, but more importantly, how can we be effective in the long run? So the people that we're bringing together locally, I mean, Street Roots wants to build something powerful and big from the ground up that is affecting change. And I think for far too long, we have been in a place where we have been reactionary. We've reacted to anything and everything on the streets. And I think we're taking a step back. We're gathering all the tools that we need in the toolbox, and then we'll move forward and hopefully be able to create some real change locally. And by working with groups like RAP, I think it's going to have a ripple effect. The work that we're doing, it's not measurable right now, but we know that it's an exciting time on the homeless front to be able to be pushing some of these things forward.
Well, it's a good example of the sum is greater than the parts. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to that. I mean, there's a real combination that strengthens each different part. I'm also interested in the Grameen Bank got the Nobel Peace Prize recently. That's microenterprise. And I know that vendor empowerment is something that you want. This is sort of a future project, but I think it's really an important one to help vendors sort of move forward. Could you talk a little bit about what you would like to see, say, in the future?
Yeah. Street Roots is currently going through a strategic planning process, and we're looking at what's real, what's not. And one of the things that we're looking at down the road is what it means to start creating some more microenterprises. One of those, the ideas that are out there, hot dog stands, coffee carts, how we can take some of the senior vendors that they're ready, they're in a place, and they want to continue to do the work, and how we can create some living wage jobs. It might, it's not an end all be all solution, but again, it's being able to be a part, a slice of a larger pie. And we're looking at a lot of different micro enterprise ideas out there, and how we can fill a niche with that.
Well, there's also the opportunity, very obviously, of teaching people how to do newspaper work.
That's correct. Yeah,
work in printing, layout, all the rest of it, copy editing.
That's correct. And I mean, currently, the Street News. If you ever get a chance, you should come down and visit the Street Roots newsroom. It's one area, and in the morning, it's a drop-in center. It's a place where we're open 365 days a year. People are coming in, getting coffee, getting warm. And at 10 o'clock it turns into a quote unquote newsroom, and vendors and people on the streets are coming in and doing lunch. But, there's an amazing, amount of talent on the streets. And so, currently, there are a lot of people on the streets that we incorporate into the everyday operations of Street Roots. Sometimes we haven't done the best job in the past of messaging exactly how we've connected that, but it happens every single day.
Street Roots has not yet been displaced or gentrified out of Old Town, but so can you give the address?
Street Roots is at 211 Northwest Davis, at least for the next 2.5 years.
So that gives you time to get down there, fair listeners. 2.5 years, you better make it down there. So we are at the wrap-up part of our show. I have to say, when we have guests as compelling as Paul and Israel on, I always look up at the clock at this point and say, dang, I just started thinking. Yeah, I'm just ready to get talking. But I want to repeat a couple things. I want to, first of all, Paul, I want to thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you.
And I want to repeat that website. It's www.rap.
No, WRAP.
HOME.
Dot org.
RapHome.org.
RapHome.org.
Nothing solves homelessness like a home.
Nothing solves homelessness like a home.
Yes.
So, and this report will be released on
Tuesday the 14th, next Tuesday.
And then any of our listeners, you can go to the website, get a free copy of this report. Definitely you got to do this. Go to your Street Roots vendor, get a button. Also, this week, November 11th, it's Veterans Day. We talk a lot about supporting our troops. A lot of our former troops are living out in the streets right now. So if you want to do something this Veterans Day, call your representative, call your senator and say, we need housing for veterans. We need to support our troops when we get home. They've done their time. We need to help them.
And hopefully the new Congress won't promote cuts to VA benefits the way the previous Congress has. Also wanted to mention Street News Service that Israel mentioned
yes.
is available online. Excellent source of news. Street News Service spelled out one word, .org.
.org. Well, thank you very much for everybody tuning in. You know, the election night last night was one step in a much longer journey that I think we talking to Paul, talking to Israel, we've already begun. We're moving down that path. Join us. Come with us. And in the meantime, let's hope that these new folks that we got in the office can achieve something good.
Michael, I'd like to ask you about in the state legislature. I know the Housing Alliance statewide is going to be pushing for some changes, and it looks promising.
I'll tell you this, and we'll have a longer expansion on another show, but folks, we can make a real difference in our state legislature coming up in the next 6 months. There's a plan in place by the Statewide Housing Alliance. We're going to get $100 million for affordable housing for regular working people, for retirees, for veterans. Stay tuned. Hole in the Bucket will keep you informed. Thank you very much. This is 90.7 KBOO FM. This is Michael Anderson.
This is Jay Themar. Thank you, Paul, very much. Thank you,
yeah,
Israel.
Yeah, peace, you guys.
Yeah, thank
Take
you.
Take care. Peace.
Good night.
September 11th and Saddam Hussein.